Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. This story begins in a way that so many other stories do too. Solid family, three athletic boys, successful household, dinner together in the family home most nights. And then there was a phone call from one of the sons saying he was considering committing himself to a rehab program for alcoholism. Torin Volkman is that son. He joins us this morning to talk about the book he wrote with his mother, From Binge to Blackout, A Mother and Son Struggle with Teen Drinking. Torin Volkman lives one day at a time after successfully completing rehab and a six-month residence in a Florida halfway house. And he graduated from the University of San Diego. Congratulations, and nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, Torin, you were a Peace Corps volunteer in South America when one day you called your house and left a voice message that you were calling from Washington, D.C. When you were supposed to be in South America. What did you say to your parents that day?
Well, I wish I could remember it very clearly.
Yeah.
The fact is, it was a while ago. But I think at that point, there was a lot of unknowns still. Mm-hmm. I just kind of wanted to – I first actually left them a message and then – left them in suspense for a few hours, and then we caught up eventually. They were in Washington State. I was in Washington, D.C., and I basically...
You're supposed to be in South America with a Peace Corps, right?
Yeah, I was to be there for 2 years. This was probably about 9 months into my experience down there. And at this point, I hadn't committed to rehab. I was in sort of limbo.
You had told the Peace Corps folks that you were having some struggles in mm-hmm. South America, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I had been flown back, had been medically, technically detoxed, and I was sort of waiting to find out what was going to happen, and I just was trying to touch base with them and let them know where I was. And mm-hmm. at that point, I just said, you know, I'm in Washington, D.C., everything's going to be fine, and I was very, very much downplaying everything because I was also downplaying it to myself. You know, mm-hmm. things will be all right. We're just here to work something out, and I'll be back. I should be back in South America in no time. That was the narrative that was playing out in my mind, at least.
But things weren't all right. But what happened to you in South America? What was going on with you at the time?
It definitely was dramatic in a lot of ways in the moment. But if you really kind of like unpack a lot of it, it was something that's happening and happens to a lot of people all the time. It was yeah. a slow realization to me that when I drank, I was having problems, you know, that's the simple way to put it. And these problems weren't new. It wasn't anything that began when I went in as a beginning volunteer in South America. It was stuff that was going on when I was 16 and 18 and 20. It just was a slow progression of alcoholism.
Yeah, and what kinds of problems were you having when you drank?
Well, I guess a lot of the simple ways of looking at it were just like inability to control how much I was drinking. And that was a very, like, a creeping sensation because in college, when I drank just like a lot of people, you know, it's the weekend, it's sort of like a release. It's, I'm going to go out and have tons of fun. I'm going to, you know, I'm meeting new people, whatever right. you think you're doing in college. I was doing a lot of those things under the guise of, getting an education and having mm-hmm. fun. So I was drinking really heavily and never really trying to control it. The difference was when I got to South America about a year-ish after college graduation, I was in a different role, you know, in a different culture and tons of new responsibilities in my own Peace Corps assignment. And when alcohol was around, suddenly I wasn't just kind of unleashing and going and doing anything I wanted. I was in these confined, controlled situations trying to socialize. And I found almost immediately that I was not able to just drink normally. And there had been suspicions, there had been problems before. It's not like this was a total surprise, but it was shocking to me how uneasy I was around alcohol.
So you call mom, you call dad from that day in Washington, D.C. Did you have any sense of what kind of worry you were placing on them when you made that call and said, hey, I'm not in South America, I'm in Washington. Things are going to be fine, but we got to talk.
Yes and no. I mean, I guess I was 24 years old, so yeah. I still kind of like felt like I had everything figured out. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that you can't have things figured out at that age, but for me, especially in my late time in college and you know, I felt like, oh, I got this figured out. Don't worry about it, you know. And I figured that if I wasn't worried about it, why should they be worried about it?
Yeah.
So honestly, I didn't pay huge mind to like what kind of distress this was going to put, especially on my mom, just being my mom.
You know, just backing away from your situation for a moment, you know, kids, high school kids, college kids and drinking, parents worrying about it. This is an age-old problem. You know, why is this such a struggle? What is it about this particular aspect of our culture, alcohol in this case, that is such become such a difficult situation for so many parents to come to grips with?
Well, I don't, it's a like you're saying, it's really complicated, and
yes,
I think
it shouldn't be, but
there,
it is.
There's several ways to even to look at what is complicated or what is the actual problem. And I mean, I've been spending the last 7 years essentially of my life traveling out and speaking and talking about the book, and in that I've probably learned more than I've actually taught others. You know, I've seen tons and tons of different communities, and I think there's more than a twofold problem here, but one of them we could say the way that alcohol is embedded into our general culture, and then two, the way it's playing out with youth and teens, young people. So whichever way you shake it, our alcohol is a huge part of our culture in general. And I think in a way our culture has really become obsessed with a lot of different things that are material, that are very quick fix oriented, are very into surplus now, you know, all of these things that have sped up in our culture. And then there's that sense for youth that they're making their own decisions, they're entitled, they're programmed as a young person to not bear the weight of the world. Youth really do feel like nothing can affect them adversely. Yeah. And that helps them in a lot of ways.
For you, you have a couple of brothers, I should point out, but for you, the draw, the attraction to alcohol was what?
Probably just like the newness of it, that next realm, that next level, the excitement, just the like seductive nature of drinking something that changes the way you feel, that makes you more loose, you know, ready to like socialize. I think all of those things, there's a huge glamour to not only alcohol, but a lot of the drug and alcohol culture, those behaviors that are there. And it's broadcast through all the different forms of media that make it look so good.
You know, as you travel the country and even the world and you talk about this, have you come up with any sort of magic bullet ideas that would sort of take away the stigma and the glamour around alcohol and sort of lessen the weight of this problem for so many families, at least in this country, who struggle with this?
No.
As a matter of fact.
Had I, no offense, I probably wouldn't be right here.
It'd be a heck of a book, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'd be selling out arenas.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that should necessarily be the goal. I mean, I just don't think we're ever going to, like, take away some of the glamour necessarily. I think the goal needs to be a little bit more oriented towards just the other realities that come with maybe the fact. I think we need to give in to the idea that it is glamorous and it is sexy and it does look cool. But what else comes with that?
But you wouldn't, you know, some parents think, well, hey, if we start giving our 10-year-olds sips of wine at the dinner table so they get used to it and they no longer are just amazed by what a glass of wine is or a sip of beer, that's the way to deal with it. Or, you know, to have all the kids over to their house, everyone can drink and we'll supervise. You know, some folks think that's the way to go, and it doesn't seem to work very well either that way.
Sure. I mean, I don't know. I guess that's sometimes one of the best things you can say is, I don't know. What I have found, and usually the resounding majority of parents say, that they're not okay with their teens being served. They're not okay with just taking the car keys away. I think most parents in general do know better than that. But one of the things that a lot of times parents come up against is the same peer pressure that teens are facing in a different way. The parents don't want to be seen as the whistleblower. Parents don't want to be seen as the one that isn't fun. Parents want to be friends with their kids a lot of times.
Which is silly. I mean, because parents are parents and they got a job to do here, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that what everyone, experts sort of say that? Yeah.
Right. So, I think even the role of parenting in some ways needs to be re-examined in our culture as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. We're visiting with Torin Volkman, if you're just joining us this morning on UpToDate. He's the author, with his mother, Chris, of a book, From Binge to Blackout, A Mother and a Son Struggle with Teen Drinking, and they did struggle here. Let's set the table here a little bit, Torin. You're the youngest of three boys, and you were 24, you said, when you made this phone call to your parents. Your parents more or less thought they were done with child rearing and dealing with monumental problems at that point in their lives. How did they react to your phone call eventually? How did things go from that point forward?
Well, I'd say for them, it was a pretty tumultuous, pretty emotional time. I mean, there was no real way to, like, fast forward to the point where things were okay. We just had to do our things. And that, to me, meant returning back to that assessment counselor and getting the news that I was not going to be allowed to go back to the Peace Corps. I was diagnosed an alcoholic and that I had really no other option, that I had to either go into treatment and leave the Peace Corps or leave the Peace Corps. So I was hit with, I guess you could call them consequences. I was choosing, in essence, to do everything. This wasn't punitive, but so I had my path to take, and then it was...
But it was hard for you to leave the Peace Corps because you loved that, right?
Sure,
you loved the work, you were enjoying what you were doing, you thought you were making a difference?
Yeah, I mean, I was really just starting. I'd been there for 9 months, and I think it was more at that point of immersing myself in the culture. I was living in my own community there and learning two languages and... just
where were you exactly?
In that's a good question. In South America, in Paraguay, a rural town.
North, south?
South, central. And so, I mean, it was a very, like, agriculture-oriented community and very small. And it was really neat. These people were just warm and open. So, yes, I wanted to be there. So losing that option or opportunity was a huge consequence for me. And I think it was something that helped me realize, like, it's time for me to really figure this out. You know, it was a big deal. And having to decide to go into treatment and really face what I was going through allowed me to really commit to the decision, as well as it forced my parents and my friends and my family overall to really face the fact that he's not in Peace Corps anymore. He's going into rehab. And so it did send us all into this kind of new way of picturing what we were as a family and what I was as a alleged to be recovering alcoholic.
Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, so we were just off the air just for a few moments. If you want to catch up with what you missed, you can go to our website. After the show, we'll have the podcast up. Just go to kcur.org, click on programs. You'll go to our program up to date. If you want to join our conversation here with Torin Volkman and get some of his thoughts about this struggle between teenage drinking and how parents respond to it, 816-235-2888, our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. So that was your situation. How about your parents? How did they respond? How did things change for them?
I think there was a period of time where they didn't understand exactly what had gone on. I did send some journal writing home to them via email, and actually to my brothers. And that was sort of just a way of putting out to them what I had been going through. And I think they...
What did you say in those emails, in those diary entries?
Well, those were... A lot of it was just one really long night of writing. It was sort of like my pivotal come-to moment where I realized, like, I had a problem, and I just wrote and wrote about it. And that ended up being one of the chapters in the book. And for me, that was just sort of like a clearing of the air and a way for them to see that this isn't something that just happened.
You said what? Give us a flavor of what you wrote.
Well, I mean, a lot of the writing was really chronicling the months before I went to into the Peace Corps, actually, talking about some other traveling experience I had, some of the symptoms, some of the withdrawal, the blackouts and sweats and shakes, and just really feeling sick, and some of the real, I guess, tendency to, like, inability to control my drinking.
And this was to hit your family like a baseball bat, right?
Yeah. And my mom describes in the book, like, that she was in her kitchen when she was reading some of those things, and she said, like, the, you know, talked about the granite tabletops not being able to keep her supported. You know, it was very mom theatrical, but it was real.
But it's real.
Totally real. And I think my mom
my legs would buckle too.
Immediately,
just to work clear.
I think she was immediately just like overwhelmed with senses of I could have done more, or I was looking the other way. All these things came back over the years, the arrests, the things that had happened when I was in high school. You know, there were blatant signs that not only was I abusing alcohol, but I was in trouble with it, and over again, and, you know, tons of regret.
What did happen in high school? You had a minor in possession?
Yeah, I had several of those.
Several of those. Okay. Mm-hmm. Caught drinking any number of times?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and pretty good consequences levied by my parents at different times, but there was just a constant cycle where I would be in trouble, I would, you know, be sincerely apologizing and kind of being well-behaved for a while, not in trouble, under the radar, and then another series of events would unfold where I'd be in trouble again with similar groups of friends. And it just was this constant kind of like push and pull.
So they would ground you for long stretches of time, and it didn't work because ultimately you're an alcoholic.
Yeah, and a lot of addiction experts or people would say you were hooked or an alcoholic from the first sip. And you know, I think there is some truth to that. You can wonder about the genetics. You can look at all these different things. But if you look at the trajectory of my behaviors, I was pretty much infatuated and excited. And alcohol became a necessity for my social life almost immediately.
Mm-hmm. All key warning signs for parents to look out for.
Sure.
Yeah. And so what did your parents – how else did they respond to what was happening with you?
I think at that point they spent a lot of time together. I think my mom didn't – I know this. She did not really socialize for another few weeks because she wasn't ready to, like, I guess, fully talk about it. She wasn't ready to tell her best friends, even her parents or maybe her sisters.
Because your family, again, just to give some context, you're a pretty model family on a lot of levels.
Yeah.
As I mentioned in the opening, eating dinner together most nights and – grandparents, supportive grandparents living nearby, and successful careers for both your mom and dad, and things going the right way in a lot of ways here, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You know, not perfect, but pretty solid.
Yeah, things were a pretty solid, I guess you could say. I
mean, you guys were athletes, all three of the, mm-hmm. you and your two brothers, athletes and successful athletes and all that stuff, right?
Right, yeah, a recipe for a really good outcome. And for the most part, things were going very smoothly in a lot of different ways. It was a time of transition. All of the kids were well out of the house. And I think, like you had mentioned before, my mom and dad felt like their parenting in a lot of ways was over. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of this not only proved that wrong, but it also sort of eroded at the version of the parents that they had turned out to be. It was like, wait, what? We raised an alcoholic? And then how did that happen? And so, like I said, there was a lot of guilt and shame even for my mom.
They felt like they failed.
In a way, yeah. And
I think, did they fail?
No, not at all. And I mean, I think they felt like they had failed me. But I think there was still a lot of learning to do. And that's part of what healing is in the end, is just like reinventing and rediscovering what is the truth? What did happen? And who is responsible? And at times, there are different truths. And at times, you find out no one really is responsible. That's just the way it worked out. If you look back at our story, my parents did amazing. They did all kinds of things to help me. And in the end, I think that did help me reach out for help in the end. So,
and they were ultimately very supportive of what you were doing in Washington, D.C., and then as you returned home and everything else.
Yeah, I think we just all kind of had to stumble into it blindly, not knowing how to really respond. I think there's for the average family that's inexperienced with addiction firsthand, there's not a lot of language floating around to even talk about it. We don't really know how to confront it. And that's what my parents faced, was that isolation of most families probably can't, if they can, they don't want to relate to us right now. Mm-hmm. And they didn't really know who to talk to. And of course, like, as I look back on this, it all seems so dramatic, but the reality is any family that does deal with addiction, just like a family that deals with cancer or something, it hits them almost overnight, you know, and or it can be one of those long, slow progressions. But one way or the other, until you're in it, it's hard to relate to as an outsider that doesn't have that in their family.
Yeah. 816-235-2888. We want to get your questions, get your stories about how you've dealt with kids maybe who have struggled with alcoholism or really anything else. 816-235-2888, our email address, update@kcur.org, or again, go to KCUR's Facebook page. So then what happened? You sort of went through rehab, and then tell us about your journey since those days.
Well, I did my 30 days of treatment in a 30-day inpatient rehab facility in like rural Pennsylvania. That's where they were sending Peace Corps volunteers at the time. So at that point, I was really in it, you know, just like into the idea that I'm in treatment. And even when I arrived there, it kind of felt like this thing that I had always thought would happen. It was really strange. I mean,
you could see the journey coming to this point.
Yeah, yeah. It just made sense.
Like, yeah.
It kind of felt like I belong here in a certain way. And in my mind, I was also the whole time looking at ways to exclude myself from the table of addiction, you know? And so I took that seriously, and I kind of treated it like it was a summer camp, but also kind of like maybe the most important, like 30 day education I could ever get. And so
was it enjoyable or was it hard work or both?
It was a little bit of both. I mean, there were times when it was agonizing. There was a lot of interaction with other people, and I spent a lot of time trying to figure out why I was there and how I related to these other people. There were addicts and alcoholics of all ages, of course. And
how hard was it for you to admit to yourself that you were an alcoholic?
That wasn't the hard thing. In fact, a lot of my writing from the past over those journal entries that I'd written, I kind of poured back over those and continued writing. And I figured the best thing I can do is really, really examine my symptoms and my behaviors and really be open and honest. And once I found that I was open and honest, it was very clear that I didn't really have any way or understanding of how to drink normally. And the definition of alcoholism, it can be blurry for a lot of people, but the inability to control drinking in general is a big component of that. And for me, that was clearly a huge part of my problem. Mm.
Kids and drinking is our topic today. 816-235-2888. Let's go to Kelly from Olathe. Kelly, you're on Up Today. Good morning.
Hi. I was actually calling. I have a sister who's, we're both adults. I'm 30. And she, unbeknownst to me, I guess, you know, you don't, when you're an adult, you don't live next door to your sibling normally. And you don't really know each other as adults very well. And what happened was she ended up getting a divorce. Her husband was leaving. And I guess when she was younger, she had developed a problem with alcohol, and none of us knew about it. And it all resurfaced as soon as the divorce started. And she has two children that are teenagers. And what happened at Christmas is she came up to visit, and she got wasted. Her daughter was begging her not to drink on Christmas Eve and passed out in the pumpkin pie. And there was just this huge thing. And it turned out that she was also addicted to Oxycontin or Codeine or whichever one it is.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been slowly dealing with this. We actually just cut her out of our life because she was dragging her kids through all of this stuff. And no matter what we tried to do to get her help, we couldn't get her help. And it was like a poison, like a very negative poison and everything. And right now, it's been 4 months we haven't spoken, and she just contacted me yesterday, and I think she's trying to get herself on track. But I can't express how helpless you feel as a sibling or a daughter or a father or whatever it is of someone dealing with an addiction. And it's always a symptom of a deeper problem. But the other thing I wanted to say was that what I've noticed, and I guess this is in Johns County, I grew up in a family where no one drank, not everybody was a teetotaler. And so when my sister developed this problem, we were all like, what? Where did that come from, you know? And it wasn't something that's been in the family. But since I've been in Johns County, what I've seen is that a lot of people, and I guess this is true everywhere, instead of going to see a therapist or a psychiatrist to talk about things, or going, there's such an underground stigma attached to it that they self-medicate. And in my husband's family, if you don't drink, you're not accepted.
Mm.
So we go to events, and it's constantly, let's drink. We're like, we don't drink, you know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm sure that's a double-edged sword both sides, but I wondered if you had any advice, like how do you help someone who either doesn't want help, or how can you be supportive when you're watching these people destroy their lives. And maybe he's got some insight since he's been through it. Thank you.
Kelly, thank you very much. And how do you help someone who maybe doesn't want help, Torin? That's tough stuff.
Well, thank you for the call, Kelly. That is it. I mean, that's the crux of it. This is a disease of addiction that affects the whole family. And the first thing I would say is that in most communities, if not the greater metro area of wherever you can get to, there is Al-Anon. And Al-Anon is a 12-step program, but it's geared towards the loved ones of the addict or alcoholic that is suffering. And it does hand out a lot of tools for working with somebody that in reality won't change until they're ready. So I think the understanding that you can't change somebody, you can't make them, you can't motivate them even. The best way, I think, is to be very clear with your communication and saying, you know, we love you, we support you, but we can't do this for you, and we're here to help you when you're ready. But these are the things we can do to help you, which are get you into treatment, get you seeing a therapist. But until those things are happening, we can't be around you. You know, some type of really clear boundaries are almost always necessary.
That's interesting. Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with Torin Volkman, co-author of From Binge to Blackout, A Mother and Son Struggle with Teen Drinking. We'll talk about how college students react to his message as he makes the rounds. He'll be speaking at the University of Kansas this evening. And we'll also talk about some tips for parents, what parents should be looking out for with their own sons and daughters. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation with the Secret Service agent who jumped on the back of JFK's car when those shots rang out in Dallas, you'll find that plus the story of the Titanic sister ship at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, it's time to play ball. We're live from Kauffman Stadium for a behind-the-scenes look at the Royals' home opener. This hour, we're visiting with Torin Volkman. He's co-author of a book, From Binge to Blackout, A Mother and Son Struggle with Teen Drinking. And yes, he wrote this book with his mother about his own struggles. Our phones are open, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Jen from Lawrence, Torin, asks us this via email. As a mother of teens, what behaviors should we be looking out for that signal a serious problem? What role does trust play? Do you feel your parents were overly trusting? Interesting questions.
Yeah. it's hard to say. I mean, I guess one of the things that I would be looking out and theoretically would or will look out if I have kids is, is sort of, I guess, dramatic or drastic changes in attitudes towards interests that they previously may have had, maybe types of friends that they start to surround themselves with. And a lot of times parents say that they feel like they can't control their teens, and you can't control your teens. You know, that there's got to be like an okayness to realizing that you have to let go to a certain degree. But at the same time, of course, you are in the same house with them. You oftentimes are in charge of their finances, their phone, their car, and all of those other things.
You're speaking to me in a very personal way right now.
So, I think parents do have a lot of tools they can work with. And I think one of the things that a lot of times is missing from the equation early on is that discussion before kids start even entering that realm of suspicion. Talk to them early about these things and really get that dialogue going.
Your mother is a very big proponent of that. In fact, when she speaks to groups, she recommends that parents start a dialogue about alcohol early on with kids. What exactly does she have in mind?
Well, I guess there's some key touching points that we definitely didn't even know about when I was, I guess, in that age where I was starting to drink. And this might date us, but some of the information about genetics and some of the information about the adolescent brain were actually not really solidly known back in the mid-90s when I was actually starting to drink. So I think some of the information that parents can have and talk to their kids about can start really, really early on, but some of it can talk about our own personal family history, what's going on. And the caller before, Kelly, mentioned that, you know, half of her family or a bunch of her family was a lot of teetotalers. And the reality is that was true for half of my family too. What we don't know is what was underneath the teetotaling. Like, mm-hmm. if a whole family is into a bunch of other things, but they're not necessarily drinkers, it doesn't mean that they don't carry the genetics. It just means that they're not expressed.
So, what does alcohol do to the adolescent brain? What should we know about that?
So that's a really, really important thing to understand. And I'm not a neuroscientist, and I can only give the basic idea. But basically, the onset of adolescence, ages 11, 12, all the way up to 20 to 25, that is the period besides when the fetus is developing that our brain is changing and growing the most. Mm. So if you think about a kid who's age 16, his brain is not fully formed. So mm-hmm. if you're drinking, exposing it over and over again to toxins or alcohol or a drug, which alcohol is a drug, over and over again, that brain is vulnerable. And while it's developing, it's impeding the development, but it also can change the development in a permanent way. And that's mm-hmm. essentially why we know today that kids that start drinking before the age of 14 have 5 times the chance of having problems with drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
It essentially just allows that brain to change the way it processes, and it can be a permanent change.
That's kind of scary.
It is scary, and it's really – that's like information that's not totally in our consciousness yet.
Yeah.
And I think if you even look at the smoking culture and how that's changed over a few generations, we don't allow smoking near you know, a baby or in a hospital or in any place where we know, because we know the effects of it. We know.
So if you drink as a teenager somewhat regularly, then you are susceptible to becoming a drinker or a drug user later on.
Yeah, it just increases your odds of having problems with addiction mm-hmm. later on. And a lot of times kids don't even understand what does addiction look like. And that's one of the things that I always try and portray is vividly as possible is this is how it plays out. It becomes an inability to control your drinking. It becomes, you know, all of those symptoms that come with withdrawal.
Yeah, I should point out that, Torin, you're speaking this evening as part of the third annual Jason Wren Initiative. The event starts at 7 at Budig Hall, room 120 this evening on the KU campus. The Alcohol Awareness Event is dedicated to the memory of Jason Wren and all college students who are negatively affected by alcohol. Again, that's tonight at 7 o'clock. How do college students respond to what you have to say? I mean, here you flash through their lives. What kind of impact can you have?
Sometimes it's hard to know. And I mean, mm-hmm. I've been speaking probably more in a lot of the high school environment. But I'd say over the years, every spring or fall, I go to a couple different universities. And, you know, it totally varies. But a lot of times I find that college kids are a little bit more open to the spirit of discussion just because mm-hmm. they're in that age where they're at least allowed to admit that they can drink and that yeah. drinking is a big part of their culture. So first of all, I never come in there with like an agenda. I don't have some goal to like change a drinker's mind to make them not drink. And they know that. They can sense that. So
right.
by the time that I've kind of gotten through the beginning of my story and started to turn the corner to show how it became a problem and where my attitudes changed, I think they start to realize, like, I'm there putting myself out openly and, you know, there's nothing that can come out of this but, like, a good discussion. So yeah. kids tend to like that. And college students, I think they have questions. They want to ask me questions and I can answer them. And it becomes a good discussion.
Cully from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Glad to have you.
I'm recovering, and I just wanted to make a comment of the biggest thing that I learned both when I was using and in my recovery. I think my first drink, I was 12 or 13, and it was a pint of blackberry brandy. And I remember the police picked me up and what have you and was brought home. And I think the way my parents dealt with it was, well, he's going to be hungover. That'll learn him. But for me, even though I was sick for 2 days, I had never experienced an escape like that in my life. And at that time, I was dealing with a lot of things. Dealing with depression, being in a big Irish Catholic family and being gay and not wanting to. And so all those things during puberty I was dealing with. After that drink, I was on my way to self-medicating for 30 years.
Mm.
And through my experience, the biggest thing that I learned was that when you're dealing with addiction, love is not enough. There was nobody that loved me enough for me to quit drinking, and I did not love anybody enough to stop drinking. And, you know, I was thinking, I would imagine if somebody has in their family, which I've not had to deal with, but somebody in their family has cancer, I would imagine you go through periods of guilt and anger, and, you know, how could you do this? How could you get this disease? Well, look what it's doing to everybody, which is kind of human nature. But when you're dealing with addiction, I think a lot of people get hung up to the fact where, you know, I love you. Don't you love me? Don't you love enough to do it? And when you, and in addiction, love is not enough. And I just wanted to make that comment, because so many people that I've been dealing with in my recovery, that has helped once they've realized that.
What about that love's not enough sometimes?
Yeah, well, I mean, love is definitely an important part of things, but it's true. There's tons of people that don't necessarily have a family to be there for them, or mm-hmm. don't have the network that's there that would support them and show them that love. And I think there's got to be some sort of hope, if not love, and yeah. or if not enough love. And I think every individual has to find their own version of what is worth living for. And I think mm-hmm. when you hear about an alcoholic that has a really low, that can tend to be one of the biggest challenges, is for them to find the light at the end of the tunnel that is worth moving towards. Mm-hmm. And we all find different reasons for that. A lot of times it is a spiritual quest.
What was your light?
My light was a combination of just the idea that I was a high bottom drunk, as they say. I mean, I was in the Peace Corps. I had graduated college. I was very fortunate.
High bottom drunk. What does that mean?
Means my low was not, like, I could have gone a lot lower before I got help. So okay. I got help in a state of very good fortune in a lot of ways. So for me, it was the reality that I could turn my life around pretty easily. And you know, it was time to, like, stop self-destructing, because mm-hmm. that's all mm-hmm. I was doing for years. It was choosing to party, choosing this, you know, and I was done taking the easy way out. I figured it's time to make something yeah. better. So,
Cully, thank you for the good phone call. I appreciate it. Ed from Kansas City, Kansas, good morning.
Hey, good morning, all. Thanks for taking my call. Mostly, I just wanted to call and say thank you. I've been in recovery now for over 20 years myself, and you look back and wonder. I also started as a teen drinker, and you can't help but wonder, looking back, what if somebody had recognized this and had brought it to me sooner? Because once I started drinking, obviously I was incapable of seeing it. And I was very fortunate to have enjoyed a long and good professional career despite my alcoholism. But like I said, you always have in the back of your mind the what ifs, and I'm so grateful to have a young person like yourself who's willing to carry that message to other young people and help them to have a better life so much sooner.
Mm-hmm.
So again, thank you very much. A great show, Steve.
Yeah, and thank you for the phone call. I appreciate it here. Yeah, you bet.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure to be able to just put myself out there and hopefully turn it into something useful for other people.
You know, your mother also advises seeking help from experts early on if problems arise. What did she say along those lines?
Well, I think that was one of her biggest regrets, was just trying to navigate the whole, like, teen parenting and alcohol problem alone.
With your father.
Yeah,
right?
I think their nature was, you know, we have three kids. They're all doing relatively well. The youngest one seems to be having these problems. The other two have gotten by fine.
So he'll be okay.
He'll be all right. It's just a phase, you know. Mm-hmm. He's making some bad decisions, and we can handle this. Mm-hmm. I think looking back on it, she realized that there was much more that should have and could have been done.
So you're a mom or dad, and your son or daughter comes home one evening. Clearly they've been drinking, maybe for the first time. As a mom or dad, what would you do now, Torin, as you look at a situation like that?
Well, hopefully I had done some of the groundwork ahead of time and talked mm-hmm. to them about X, Y, and Z.
Maybe the consequences?
Yeah, genetics and the brain and all of that. But whether or not that had been done, I think the first thing I would do is say, let's get counseling. Let's both go in and meet with a counselor and learn about what's going on. You know, you're not necessarily an addict or an alcoholic. You mm-hmm. know I was. It's in our family. That's my story, and it's part of your story as well. So Bringing in a third party, bringing in professional counseling is important because it doesn't have to be such a family thing. It can be an outside expert. And at the same time, you could say, let's do three and see if it – just get it started. You know, mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be like this is going to happen forever or this is only happening once. It can just be you do these three because I love you and we'll go from there.
Torin Volkman, again, is the author with his mother, From Binge to Blackout, A Mother and Son Struggle with Teen Drinking. Again, he speaks tonight over at KU as part of the third annual Jason Wren Initiative. The event starts at 7 in Beauty Hall, room 120. You can go hear him there. Thanks so much for your time.
It's a pleasure
to have you here.
Thank you.